looking for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and CRN Digital. Welcome to our program, my friends. The Reverend Barry Lynn is in the studio with us today. We're very, very fortunate. He's here in Portland, Oregon, the People's Republic of Portland, it's not a book tour. You don't have a new book out, do you?
No, I don't. We're just doing what I spend a lot of time doing, speaking about church-state separation and all the multitude of issues that are involved in that at the state, local, and national level.
That's great. Barry Lynn, the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU.org, the website for more information. We had this conversation in the morning show, but I think it's worth repeating. The founders, there was this big argument among the founders about whether the agreement was that there should be separation between church and state, and probably the argument was most clearly defined in some of the letters between Jefferson and Madison. In fact, I think I quote some of them in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, where Jefferson was concerned that if, and as was George Washington, by the way, rather outspokenly, that if church leaders ever got into elected office or were able to influence elections, that we could end up with a theocracy. And they were very clear that they did not want a theocracy. They didn't want laws being made based on religion, on the one hand. And Madison thought, you know, that's never going to happen. The American people never put up with that. But he was afraid that if government started giving money to churches, and in fact his first ever veto, in as I recall, 1812, 1813, was a veto of funds to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. And he vetoed that, saying, instead, this is a government function. We will care for the poor. We will rent a hall. If the church people want to show up and help out, that's fine, but we're not going to give them the money. And his concern was that if government started giving churches money, it would corrupt the churches and they would no longer be, their first loyalty would be to silver rather than to God. You know, the old, which side of the coin, you know, whose picture's on the coin here. We have arrived at a point, Reverend Barry Lynn, where both the nightmares, these two opposite nightmares of the same dystopia of Jefferson and Madison have come about. How has this happened?
Well, people have forgotten just the importance of the message of both Jefferson and Madison when it came to both of these issues. I mean, today, we forget that Thomas Jefferson, when he was sent resolutions from Congress for days of prayer and thanksgiving, he wouldn't sign them under the amazingly controversial, radical proposition that it ought to be churches and other religious institutions that decided when you should give thanks to God. Madison's so radical that in 1790, when he saw the first census form, there was a question, are you a member of the clergy? He said, wait a minute, we can't have that. We can't count the number of clergy. Even that would violate the separation principle. So now today, if those guys were around giving the speeches I give today, I'd like to think, you know, that they'd be on our side, and I'm sure they would be.
Oh, yeah.
But Ann Coulter would sit around going, those are treasonous people for doing that, you know, and Bill O'Reilly would screech about them. And there's no doubt that we have forgotten a part of our history, and it's not a particularly radical part of our history. We've forgotten a lot of that too, but it's pretty conservative. It says if you want the church to be the church and you want government not to have to pick and choose among differing religious or non-religious views, you just keep a decent distance between institutions of government and those of religion. We're all better for it. We have 2,000 religions in America, 20 million non-believers. We do get along pretty well together, relatively speaking. As a consequence, this is the best form of a relationship between church and state anywhere in the world, and we are about to bungle it if we go and pay attention to the likes of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, and the other leaders of the so-called religious right.
Or I call them the religious Reich.
That's a good phrase, actually. You don't mind if I steal that?
No, okay, go for it. Go for it. And in fact, I lived in Germany in 86, 87, and with our family. We have three children. And I remember when our second grader was enrolling for school. This was all in German, of course. We lived in this little town in the middle of nowhere, and nobody spoke English. And the forms came home where we had to fill out all the information. And on the information, it said, what's your religion, Catholic or Protestant? Those are the only two choices because they have compulsory religious classes there. And employers deduct from your salary money to tithe to the church. I mean, there's a real connection there that is a remnant of Hitler's intermingling church and state in a big way, elevating Pastor Mueller to Reichsbishop, who eventually committed suicide. And it's really interesting. My wife, looking at this, you know, Catholic or Protestant, you know, she took it to Herr Mueller, the guy who a good friend of ours, who he's now 92 years old. In fact, I'll be seeing him in a few weeks. Started this international charity that we've been doing volunteer work for 27 years with, and said, you know, what should I do with this? And he creates another box, you know, and puts a check mark on it and writes free Christian on it. It's like, you know, here's your other category. But I mean, there was no Jewish category.
No.
There was no Muslim category. And it really got me in touch with how important our traditions in America are of having secular, that the whole point of governance and of education, for that matter, should be to govern and to educate. And the whole point of religion and, you know, religious, you go to church to save your soul, to get inspired, to, you know,
sure,
for the million reasons that people go to church, and pastors like yourself do what you do for the reasons that you do it. Very different than the reason of, you know, making sure the sewer works or that the streets are clean.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, one of the other things I'm sure you noticed about Germany was there aren't too many people actually attending church. That is to say, you're going to find a much higher percentage of freely choosing church Americans, even though we don't have the kind of religion tax that they do in Germany. So one of the things that happens when Uncle Sam or Uncle anybody, Uncle Heinrich or Uncle anybody, decides to support the church, the people who used to give their $5 every week to the church say, well, now that the government is doing it, we don't have to worry about doing it ourselves. And one of the many problems with the Bush administration is they honestly think that by government subsidizing the church, it will make it stronger. In fact, all it does is divide churches. And the faith-based initiative of President Bush, which is pretty much an initiative to put faith into everything as he defines faith, is so dangerous both to the recipient churches and to the separation of church and state principle.
Now, the deal we made with churches back, I believe it was in the 1960s, I could be wrong, but the deal that we made with churches that you may be tax exempt, I, the average taxpayer, I'll pay for your fire department, I'll pay for the police department, I'll pay for the roads, I'll pay for all, you know, your septic, we'll pay for all your city services, we'll pay for your use of the commons, we'll pay for educating your parishioners, we'll pay for all of that stuff. However, the deal that we're going to make with you is if we're going to pay for all that stuff, if you're going to be tax exempt, you're not going to have to pay for your share of the commons, then in exchange for that, don't mess in the political process. Very simple deal.
It was a good deal.
And it's breaking down.
It's breaking down. And
how
of course,
can Jerry
nobody...
Falwell go on, you know, in church?
Yep.
I mean, how does this happen?
Well, what happens is the tax law says you can't endorse or oppose candidates for public office. It does not say, by the way, you can't talk about war and peace in your church. I mean, I would like to think that churches, synagogues, temples, mosques would be the places where people would talk about ethical issues, moral questions. Mm. But when you take it one step beyond that into the endorsement of candidates, that's forbidden. There is a zero tolerance policy, one of the few that I agree with, zero tolerance policy when it comes to church politicking. And some churches have lost their tax exemption because of that very issue. We've reported conduct in the last election cycle from a few progressive churches and far more, sad to say, conservative churches who have endorsed candidates. We don't know always what the IRS does. We know some churches have lost tax exemption or been fined, but it is an absolute disgrace that churches are now being... There's a bill before the Congress supported by, guess who, Tom DeLay and others, that wants to remove the restriction against church politicking so that a church, whether it's the local country church in the middle of a small town or the big mega church pulpit on radio and television, would be allowed to endorse candidates for public office and maintain their tax-exempt status. Now, other charities would still not be able to endorse candidates, but churches would. Talk about an influence on the way in which politics changes. A giant loophole in the few campaign finance laws that we have in this country, that would be it. You free up the church to endorse candidates, to dump money from the collection plate into the coffers of your favorite candidate, and we will have made a disastrous mistake. But Tom DeLay wants it. Walter Jones guy from North Carolina is another big sponsor of this measure, and it will come up in the next 6 months because one party, and I'm afraid to say it is very partisan, the Republican Party thinks this is a way they will gain more seats in the next midterm elections.
That's a tragedy. We're talking with the Reverend Barry Lynn, AU, Americans United for Church for Separation of Church and State. AU.org is website for more information. Reverend Barry Lynn, thanks so much for being in the studio.
Terrific. Nice to be here.
Do appreciate it. Great to have you here. You're one of my heroes. You're doing marvelous work,
sir. Thank you very much, Tom.
I truly appreciate it. It is 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Look out, Republicans. There's an election coming, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. I just lassoed the Reverend Barry Lynn to come back in and spend just a few more minutes with us because I noticed we have a few phone calls on topic. So let's get right to them. If you'd like to call into the program, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. And, of course, you can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Matt in Sacramento, California, presumably listening on 1240 Talk City. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi. Well, I appreciate you having your guest on because it's an important topic. And here's the question I've got. Every state constitution has a preamble. In those preambles, they all say Almighty God. What's the problem with that?
These are recent ones,
including Alaska's, which was recent. Hawaii says the Creator. Colorado says the Creator. It doesn't refer to a religion. It refers to a creator.
You know, Matt, this is Barry. I think the reason is because it sounds good to politicians to put it in, including into the most recent two state constitutions, although they do get a little more generic, as you pointed out.
Creator. Alaska's was not generic, only Hawaii's was.
Well, Hawaii's, I mean, it was what I was talking about. But the point is, these are generic references that have no legal significance. In other words, if you cited that to prove that, therefore, the state of Hawaii could go and establish Presbyterianism as the state religion.
No. I'm saying a lot of us. I've got a degree, an honors degree from the University of California in biology.
Yes.
That doesn't mean I believe in evolution.
Well,
I don't believe in the Jewish myths of creation, which is the Garden of Eden and all that garbage. I'm saying a scientist believes in the facts, and the facts are that, in my opinion, there is no way you can say it's evolution, it's creation.
Oh, see, so what you're really talking about is evolution. Well, now, look, you can have, sir, you can have a biology degree.
Let me pause you both here just for a second, because I think Matt's original question was a good one, and he said, what's wrong with the God being in the preamble to those constitutions?
And I think
the answer is probably nothing.
What's wrong about it is simply this. If you want to be honest, in any state in these United States, you would have to suggest that some people in that state believes in a God, some in gods, some in no God. If you wanted to be honest and eclectic.
The majority of us, come on now.
Majority of us believed in slavery in 1810.
Oh, come on. Majority did not believe in that.
We fought a war over it.
Did you have the Underground Railroad?
Well, because I was what we called a minority that actually did something in order to make sure that justice was served. But we don't have a majority vote on which God, if any, you should believe in. And I would think if you are truly a conservative person, you sound like you're a bit of a conservative person.
There's
nothing wrong with being
conservative.
There's nothing wrong with being a conservative. My point is,
wait a minute. You don't label me a conservative. I'm going to read you one thing, and then I'll be gone. The Virginia Declaration of Rights, Article 16, that religion or the duty we owe to our Creator in the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore all men are equally entitled to free exercise of religion, which I'm saying, according to the dictates of conscience, which I'm saying.
Okay.
Now, here's the important line that's been dropped from every constitution. It's a travesty. the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity towards each other. Strike Christian, and it'll fit all religions. Forbearance, love, and charity. Where's that in America?
Well, that's a good question.
That's a good question. There's certainly by the way, Matt, I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with being a conservative. I'm just suggesting that it is a good conservative principle, in the best sense of the word, to believe that Americans can pick what, if any, religion they will support, and that they will not expect the government to do one thing to religion or for religion except leave it alone.
Well, and here's Barry, and thank you, Matt, for that call. Barry, my concern about the word God in a constitution is that it's singular. There are some people who believe in gods.
The majority of the world's population believes in gods, to get technical about it.
Right. So, yeah. So it's promoting monotheism over polytheism, which is one category of religion, you know, if you want to kind of move up the kingdom, phylum, order, you know,
sure,
stack. So, you know, there's the problem. So, and again, the creationism versus evolution debate, that's one that's just...
No, absolutely.
It's spinning out of control now.
It is, and of course, one of the things that people have to realize, even if they're conservatives, and nothing wrong with that, is that our children are not getting quality science education. If we start teaching intelligent design in public schools, we dumb down the science curriculum. That means our children are not competitive with children in other countries for whom this fuss literally is not going on. They are not having these debates in Japan, in Germany, in England, and... that's a big problem for the future of American business. You want to get conservative about it.
Yeah, there you go. And America in general. I mean, we're all Americans here. This is the bottom line. We're all Americans. We want to see this country strong. We want to see it competent. And religion, you know, speaking as a Christian myself, you're an ordained minister. This is vital that we be able to have dialogue, that we be able to have religion, and that we be able to separate our political dialogue from our religious dialogue. You were talking about communities in, was it Southern California, that have become majority Buddhist as a result of demographic changes. They want to open the school day with Buddhist prayers, and all of a sudden the conservative Christians are coming in saying, wait a minute, we should not have prayer in school. Barry Lynn, AU.org. Thanks a lot for being with us, Barry. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour, 26 before. By the way, in the third hour of our program, David? Yeah, in the third hour of our program, we're going to have both Mark Carlin of BuzzFlash, editor of BuzzFlash, and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! On the program with us for our Best of the Rest of the News segment. That should be very interesting. Our theme for the day, have we arrived at our present position of peril in the world and at home because our leaders have refused to tell us the truth? Our quote for the day from Lord Acton, the British historian who died in 1902, did most of his writings in the late 1800s. Lord Acton said, and remember, where you have a concentration of power in a few hands, all too frequently, men with the mentality of gangsters get control. History has proven that. All power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Acton. And our question for this segment is America going to implode when the Bushies go down? Frankly, I don't think so. I think America is going to experience an extraordinary restoration and renewal when the Bushies go down. And in fact, I'm already seeing the signs of it all over. Things like this, you know, Barry Lynn here coming through Portland. He's speaking at Washington State University this afternoon. He's speaking at Portland State University this evening. Free lectures. I mean, just, you know, doing the circuit. People out there talking. People out there stirring things up. Look at what happened in Argentina last week. Basically, you know, South America saying to George Bush, take a hike, buddy. I mean, they were not even able. Coming out of that meeting, they were not even able to decide when would be the next time that they would get together to talk about whether or not they would decide anything. That's how bad it was. So, and then on top of this, we have this poll from Zogby, John Zogby, one of the most respected pollsters in the world, certainly in the United States, probably the last poll in the United States, in the opinion of most people, that hasn't been corrupted in one way or another. And John Zogby's poll that was just released on Friday got no mention in the press. Surprise, surprise, in the mainstream media. Asked the question, if you learned that George W. I'm paraphrasing the question. I don't have it in front of me, but it was to this effect. If you learned that George W. Bush had lied about the reasons why we went to Iraq, would you favor impeaching him? 53% of Americans said yes. That was on Friday. Then on Sunday, the New York Times published the story demonstrating how these lies took place. Oh, we had the world's best intelligence. We had this great. We had an informer who told us that Osama bin Laden was working with Al Qaeda. I mean, ignore the fact that the CIA, the common sense would tell you this is impossible. As the Defense Intelligence Agency pointed out, Saddam Hussein would not work with al-Qaeda because he couldn't control it. And it was a religious organization, and he was secular, number one. Number two, Osama bin Laden actually tried to invade Iraq and dethrone Saddam Hussein at one point in time because Hussein was allowing people to drink alcohol in his country. He was allowing women to work and to go to school and to vote. He was allowing, you know, to the extent that you could vote in Iraq, he was allowing women to participate in civil society. They could show their elbows. They didn't have to cover their heads. This totally flipped out the late Osama bin Laden. And, now long dead, I think everybody's becoming convinced that Osama bin Laden has been dead for at least 3 years. But I digress. On Sunday, the New York Times published a memo that was recently declassified, passed along by Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. God bless him if you live in Michigan, and I'm not sure when Carl Levin is up for re-election, but do everything you can to keep this man in the United States Senate. He is extraordinary. And what it shows is that this fellow by the name of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, terrible irony there, at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba in 2003, as the result of torture. Well, Dick Cheney would say, it's not torture, it's waterboarding, it's stress positions, it's just electrodes on the genitals. This is not torture. In any case, this guy, Libby, down in Guantanamo Bay, says, you want me to tell you that Saddam Hussein was training al-Qaeda? I'll tell you Saddam Hussein was training al-Qaeda. Just quit hurting me. And so George Bush comes out in October and of 2002 in Cincinnati in his major speech and says, quote, we've learned that Iraq has trained al-Qaeda members in bomb-making and poisons and gases, end quote. His source, al-Libi. It turns out that at the time that Bush got this information via the Defense Intelligence Agency, which had been interrogating this guy wherever they had him captive before they finally moved him to Guantanamo Bay in 2003. The Defense Intelligence Agency said, quote, the information that al-Libi was, quote, intentionally misleading the debriefers, end quote. Now, this guy is lying. They're not saying why he's not. Yeah, it may be that he's lying to stop the torture. It may be that he's lying to, I mean, why else would he say, yes, Saddam Hussein is working with Osama bin Laden? But they knew he was lying. As the New York Times writes, Doug Gell, this reporter in the New York Times, this document provides the earliest and strongest indication of doubts voiced by American intelligence agencies about Mr. Libby's credibility. That's Mr. Libby, the prisoner. Without mentioning him by name, Mr. President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, and other administration officials repeatedly cited Mr. Libby's information as credible evidence that Iraq was training al-Qaeda members in the use of explosives and illicit weapons. Among the first and most prominent assertions was one by Mr. Bush, who said in a major speech in Cincinnati in October 2002 that we've learned that Iraq has trained al-Qaeda members in bomb-making and poisoning gases. And now they know the guy was lying. They knew at the time the guy was lying. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. That, and it, I mean, this was one of their main sources of information. The other two main sources of information, curveball, the alcoholic nephew or step-nephew or whatever of Chalabi, who was basically telling them anything that they wanted to hear as long as they kept paying him. Oh, yes, they have mobile weapons laboratories. Yes, indeed. The CIA had already discounted this guy, but Cheney goes, ah, we'll take that information anyway. And then we'll pass it along to John Kerry and everybody else in the Senate and the House. And then these Democrats in the Senate and the House, they come out and they've read Al-Libby's confession, his tortured confession, without knowing that it's a tortured confession. They've read Curveball's information without knowing that he's being paid. They've read Ahmed Chalabi's statements without knowing that Ahmed Chalabi is actually working for the Iranians, who want to get Saddam Hussein out of power so badly that they fought a 10-year war and lost a million people over it. And so some Democrats come along and say, yeah, hey, you know, it's terrible. Tim Russert thought he had Ted Kennedy blindsided yesterday. He quotes John Kerry without saying it's John Kerry, right? Oh, that's Saddam Hussein. We know he's got weapons. After 9/11, we can't allow, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Kennedy sort of takes the bait. He goes, yeah, he says, you know, that's the kind of thing that's the result of bad intelligence. Well, it wasn't bad intelligence. I'm sorry. It was cherry-picked intelligence from bad sources, and we knew they were bad sources. It was the intelligence we wanted, at least at the highest levels of government. You had a lot of people inside the CIA saying, no, we don't want this intelligence. So on Friday, 53% of Americans said we would impeach Bush if we knew that he lied. On Sunday, the New York Times runs the article saying, here's the proof that he lied. I mean, in my words, not theirs. And is it covered in the mainstream media? Somehow it's not. Why? Because they want to preserve their access to the White House, as Dan Rather recently pointed out. As I've been telling you for 3 years on this program. It's the reason why there was this little AP story in 2000. In January of 2000, after the Supreme Court ruled that George Bush should be installed as president, even though Al Gore got more votes in Florida, by pretty much any way you count it, when the Supreme Court installed George Bush, CNN sends a vice president up to Washington, D.C. to assure the Bush administration that they will get favorable coverage on CNN. Why? Because the Bushies had said, essentially, to everybody, you don't play with us, you don't play our game, you don't get to play. And any news agency knows if they can't play, if they can't talk to senior administration officials, if they're not invited to the news conferences, they are out of business. I mean, just ask Kellen Thomas about that. And now we got Scotty McClellan out here spinning like crazy. He says, oh, there's no need to investigate the manipulation of intelligence. And this is in Wednesday's press gaggle. No, we don't need to look into this. It's come on, everything's fine. But it's clear now that these guys lied us into this war, that they absolutely lied us into this war. And when is the mainstream media going to start talking about this? I mean, they were certainly willing to talk about Clinton getting a BJ in the office. When are they going to talk about this? When are they going to talk about the really serious issues of our day? Clinton having consensual sex with another adult. Oh, that's so bad that on the floor of the House of Representatives, they have to read about cigars and private parts and things. But lying us into a war? No, we're not going to talk about that. This is, we need to be waking up our media, my friends, as well as our politicians. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hallelujah, dads and mommies, cowboys, rebels, yanks, and commies, buy yourselves some real red-blooded fun.
If you want to make the grade, you've got to have a hand grenade and a fully automatic GI gun. So buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him place her.
And welcome back, my friends.
Expand, place a weapon in his hand for this guilt he learns today will someday pay, sir.
There you go. It's 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-440-8466. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. Long time on hold today. Must be a busy day.
It is a busy day, yeah. The lines are all jammed. What's up?
You know, I can't understand why these, you know, U-boat Wolf on CNN and others have no memory of history whatever. Do you think the Germans didn't torture the insurgents in occupied France to get information on the day of the invasion? Do you think they didn't torture the Free French?
The Germans are torturing a lot of folks. What's your point here?
My point is this: they sure were in the dark about when and where the invasion of Normandy was going to occur.
Oh, okay.
If torture worked, they would have been ready and knowing, wouldn't they? Now,
sure. Yeah, yeah.
All right. How about the Japanese? Do you think the Japanese didn't torture anybody?
No, they were very, very good at it.
Okay, but did they get any information so that they won World War II instead of us?
I don't think so. No. No. And we ended up being the moral leaders to which the world looked.
That's right. And what was but I can't remember, but there was a number three man in the Reich took a plane and
Rudolf Hess.
Hess. Now, Hess was a very important person. Did the British torture him to get information?
You know, well, actually, I don't think so. No, they just put him in prison.
No, they didn't, because they obviously didn't get anything. So my point is, just all you have to do is look at simple history and use a little common sense, and you can figure out that torture has never worked.
Well, and in fact, the flip side of that is, I actually, the year that I lived in Germany, I knew somebody who visited Hess in prison in Berlin.
Oh.
And Hess did spill his guts to the British.
Oh.
When he was captured by the British. He was trying to end the war.
Right.
Hess, in fact, I had this conversation yesterday with Armin Lehmann, who was the 16-year-old courier in the Führer bunker with Hitler when Hitler committed suicide. And when the Goebbels fed their six children poison and then committed suicide themselves. And in fact, he's going to be in the studio this afternoon. After we get off the air, we're going to record a few segments that we'll play a little later on. Armin has a book out about this. And, you know, he's Hitler's last courier, literally. And I forgot where I started. Oh, Hess. And Hess actually went to Armin and I were talking about this yesterday. I said, why did Hess go to England? And he said, well, apparently, you know, there were people. Hess thought that he could negotiate as a diplomat on behalf of Germany and negotiate a truce. And when he got to England, apparently the people in Germany who had told him, we'll be with you, were so terrified of Hitler that they weren't with him anymore. And so he was unable to negotiate a truce. And so, you know, he made friends with the Brits made friends, but, you know, he told him whatever he knew. And then after the war, of course, he got transferred to Spandau prison in Germany. But anyhow, end of that. Phil, thanks a lot for the call and for raising points. It's a good one. Chris in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Oh, great. You know, Tom, I've been a long time fan of yours, but just from a distance, you know what I mean?
Well, thank you for calling, Chris.
Yeah, great. I love the way you approach issues with substance. And without a lot of hyperbole, but one of the things that caught my attention was your last subject when you were talking about religion and politics and God and the Constitution and all of that.
Actually, God's not in the Constitution. God is in the Declaration of Independence,
right,
but
right.
That's not a... Yeah.
But my overall point very quickly is that I think this administration, without politicizing it, I think this administration is at fault for what's going on with the divisions in our country when it comes to religion.
Oh, sure. They engineered it. It's
correct.
The only way. These guys represent such a minority viewpoint in America. You know, this is the super right wing, that the only way that they can maintain any kind of semblance of power is by dividing us up and trying to conquer us.
But what makes this so dangerous is the fact that because politics has gotten in bed with religion, and which is a dangerous mix, because everyone obviously don't believe in the same God or the same view of God or creation or all of these things.
Or religious
rules.
The
point that I make is that this division is more is going to be more dangerous to this country than anything else, because we can see what's happening in the Middle East when religion and politics is mixed and people, you know, they get ideas that they will die for, which I believe we have ideals in this country religiously that we would die for. But when you mix it in with politics, it becomes very incendiary. And the biggest thing, the biggest mistake this man made and the country made in selecting him president is the fact when you bring a guy in that says, I'm better than the last guy because I'm religious. I'm better than the last guy because I don't drink. And everybody can see before their eyes that this guy is back to drinking, in my view.
Yeah.
But my whole point is, because of this religious attitude, you know, and in fact, really, the Republican Party is being duped by that, by the religious right, rather, is being duped by the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah.
Because of this abortion issue. And I've never heard a news person put this question, Tim Russert or anyone else, put this question to a Republican. Why haven't you not advanced a bill on the floor of the Senate or the House that does away with abortion? They will not do it.
To criminalize abortion. No, they love having abortion legal because it gives them a boogeyman that they can yell about. You're absolutely right, Chris. Chris, we got to wrap it up here, but I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Thank you very much. And by the way, you made the comment, you know, why did we select Bush? We didn't. The Supreme Court selected Bush in 2000, and I am convinced we selected John Kerry in 2004. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind now, having read John Conyers' report, which you can buy in any bookstore. Go check it out on BuzzFlash.com. No doubt in my mind. But that's a whole... And Mark Crispin Miller's new book, you know, it's a... But that's a whole other issue. Our program, by the way, brought to you by Small Good Aug Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Welcome back to our program. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. Jeffrey runs a website, it's frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be back.
Great to have you with us. Jeffrey, you spent a lot of time looking into the psychological dimension of how things are framed, or at least the framing dimension of how political arguments are made. And you've been blogging or writing a lot recently at frameshopisopen.com about this whole concept of Cheney being silent, even if he's the spider at the center of the web, or maybe Bush is. But, you know, why aren't these guys being held accountable? Why aren't the questions being asked? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I've just put up a few more posts on the site because so much is going on today. What's really amazing about what's happened since the Fitzgerald indictment of Cheney's assistant was handed down was that the whole conception of Cheney as this ominous, silent power broker in the administration has changed. A couple of weeks ago, when you looked at Cheney, he was the man standing in the back of the room with all the gravitas. He was the one in charge, this big figure of authority. Bush did the talking, but we know that Cheney was the one making the choices. But since the indictments came down, Cheney has really become this symbol of deceit. The more he stands out in front of the public and doesn't explain what's happening, the more it seems that he has something to hide. And it's incredible because outlets like the Washington Post have really been putting out in front of the American people all these revelations about what Cheney's doing, and the vice president continues to not talk. So there's been a major shift in the logic through which the American public is looking at the vice president. And even if the vice president doesn't end up being indicted or end up being named on some legal action, he's really been transformed from this major political asset to the Republican Party into this political liability. And I just don't see any way out of it for him, although they're definitely going to try to run something.
Well, what's the major frame that they're having to struggle with right now, and what's the major frame that you think that they're putting out there to try and replace it?
Well, I noticed that today the big frame that's unfolding is this have to do with the torture allegations, this notion that this reality that there's a network of secret prisons that are set up all over Europe, Eastern Europe predominantly, where the CIA is taking prisoners that they're capturing in this so-called war on terror, pulling people out and putting them in these former Soviet prisons. Now, it's a CIA network, but it appears that it was signed off and really aggressively pushed by Cheney. And this violates all kinds of laws, American laws, international laws. And so what the administration is doing is they're running this communications game in which they are basically claiming that no torture has happened, that there is no violation of the law. Cheney is being quiet about something that he has been implicated in by everybody from, reporters in the United States, reporters all over Europe, people on both parties coming out. And meanwhile, Bush is pushing this frame that the United States doesn't break the law, that there is no torture, that everything they're doing is legal.
And yet at the same time, I noticed over the weekend that the news programs, particularly Wolf Blitzer, but many of the news programs were promoting the ticking bomb frame. What do you do if you've got somebody in custody that you know that they had something to do with planting a bomb in Grand Central Station? It's going to go off in an hour. You have them in custody. Do you torture them or not?
Yeah, I mean, this is the idea that they're putting out, that torture is about interrogation, which has been a notion that has been disproven by a wide range of people, but most notably by President Carter, who did this amazing interview with Chris Matthews last week, in which he basically said that it's well established by people in government and in academia that torture does not lead to credible information. People know that they're going to be tortured. They show up and they either present false information right away, or they just give whatever answers the person doing the interrogation wants. And so this frame of what is going on in this prison being about interrogation to protect the American people is incredibly misleading. Now, it reminds me of this very, very famous quote by George Orwell in 1984, where he says that the object of torture is torture. I mean, that's the goal of setting up these prisons. It's to scare these people, or according to what the president and Cheney obviously see, it's to fight the war on terror by being more terrified than the people that they're fighting.
In a way, isn't the rationale for torture, and back, by the way, going back to the ticking bomb frame, that's an excellent answer. You know, that number one, if somebody really did put a bomb in Grand Central Station and it's going to go off in an hour and you're torturing them, you know, they'll tell you something to get you to stop the torturing. It
exactly.
May not be where the bomb is. Secondly, do we really, you know, there may even, and here's the larger and much more difficult answer to that question, there may be times when it's conceivable, it's not inconceivable, that torture would give you the information that you need, but then you're opening the door to allowing torture. And at that point, you have so sacrificed your principles, you've won the war, we've won the battle and lost the war. You know, you've changed the fundamental nature of society.
Exactly.
But the argument that you say that they're putting forward now, you know, the torture is torture, or the argument, you know, the quoting Jimmy Carter, it's really the same argument that's used to support capital punishment, isn't it? That we're going to scare people with the possibility of death so much that they won't kill, and yet every study that's ever been done on capital punishment shows, outside of the small little chunk that gets widely quoted by the pro-capital punishment folks of, you know, people who got out of prison for a murder and then went on to commit another murder, setting that aside, because we need to fix that. But setting that aside, that those states that have the highest capital punishment rates actually have the highest murder rates, and that capital punishment does not deter murderers. And in fact, there's even some evidence that capital punishment may encourage murderers, because then they figure, okay, I'll do this murder and then they'll kill me and it'll be all over. And it's almost like a murder-suicide thing in their mind.
Yeah, and you'd think the conservatives would have figured that out, but
well, they haven't. But I mean, my point is, it's like, you know, okay, you want brutality, we'll show you brutality, and it's coming out of a psychopathology, isn't it?
I think it is, and I think that one of the things that's happened today, just this morning, in Bush's press conference in Panama, he revealed what it is that appears to be the real goal that they have when they engage these torture allegations. In his press conference this morning, Bush claimed that he invoked the logic of this so-called torture memo written by Gonzalez with the assistance of this new chief of staff of Cheney, a guy named Addington, that basically anything that the president does during a time of war to protect the American people is the law. In other words, when the president does something, it can't be in violation of the law.
In other words, he's king.
I'm sorry?
In other words, he's king.
He is king. That's right. I mean, this is the law that he's claiming. So rather than actually facing the American people, turning to these allegations and saying, look, this is what we're doing. This is how it's unfolding. We crossed the line here. We're going to step back here. Rather than doing that, they're running this spin game in which they're claiming that there is no legal definition of torture that they have violated, and then they're claiming that the president can do whatever he wants. So it's about extending the president's authority rather than facing both the letter of the law and the spirit of the American people.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
It would be a lot easier.
Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Exactly.
There you go.
It makes people nervous. I mean, there's been a flurry of activity on the blogs this morning about this one line by Bush when he says that anything we do in this war effort is within the law.
Now, that was the claim, by the way, that Hitler made. And, Hitler-Bush analogies are always flawed because, you know, Hitler was a maniacal mass murderer, a total madman. The murder of millions and millions of people in Europe, the Holocaust, all of that stuff is not in any way comparable to what we have done so far. And yet the techniques and the transformation of society have some spooky parallels. And that was the argument that Hitler made after the Reichstagsgebäude was burned, after the parliament building was burned, in asserting his power.
It's an end justifies the means type of argument.
Sure.
And the goal is to get the nation to this new moral system where we are constantly on the search for these threats that are coming at us from all over.
Yeah, so we have about 20 seconds left. Jeffrey Feldman of FrameShopIsOpen.com. What frame should we be promoting?
We should be promoting the frame that the president should stop the spin and just come clean. We should just come clean with the American people. I think that's what people want to hear. It's what people need to hear. They're tired of the president and the vice president running these communication strategies.
So just come clean. We want that to be the mantra that we commit to Bush, to Cheney, you know, answer the questions. What did Bush know and when did he know it?
What did Bush know and when did he know it is a great frame, and that's one that's being repeated left and right. I mean, whether or not we actually get to Bush is going to be a tough one. But insisting that the president speaks in a straightforward way is very powerful at this time.
Yeah, okay, so that's where we need to be. Jeffrey Feldman, FrameShopIsOpen.com. Check it out. Great website. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Always great talking to you. It's 16 minutes past the hour, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When I was a little bitty baby, my mama would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton fields back home. It was down in Louisiana, just about a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields back home.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where smart people get their news, the True People's Radio. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes, coming up on 22 minutes past the hour. And Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., our Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. The Supreme Court today has decided to take the case, an appeal by Mr. Hamdan. He's accused of being an Al-Qaeda operative. In fact, he was accused of being Osama bin Laden's driver. Now, what's so interesting about this, and actually I just got an update from Brother Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights here about this, is there are now four people that are up for these kind of military tribunals. The next one up, actually, before Mr. Hamdan is David Hicks, who's the Australian. Some of his motions, et cetera, begin this month. And the issue is, Michael was very surprised that the Supreme Court is actually willing to take this case, which means that there are, in fact, probably four justices that are very interested in this. There has to be four justices, which means that if Mr. Roberts, who ruled on this on the lower court, recuses himself, there is a possibility of a 4-4 tie. Of course, it could also be 5-3.
Why would he recuse himself, though? I mean,
he would have to recuse himself because he would not have to. Well, he doesn't have to, but he did. He did today on whether the case the court.
Oh, he did.
The case.
Oh, okay.
So my guess is that he will probably recuse himself in the long run. But this really has to do with whether they can have these special military tribunals, or whether, in fact, you can try, whether you have to try these people as prisoners of war with a regular court-martial system, or under Geneva, whether you have to essentially try them as civilians, and whether unarmed enemy combatants or armed enemy combatants can come in as common Article 3 under Geneva or Geneva 4.
Right.
And the lower court ruled that Geneva applies. Obviously, the appellate court said that it did not apply. And so now the question is, it goes before the Supreme Court, and that will be very interesting. Expected to hear it in spring.
I understand that George Bush this morning said that if he does something like, you know, ordering torture, for example, it doesn't matter if it's against the law, because if he's the president during time of war, he gets to make the law.
He didn't really say that quite in that way. But he said, he talked about lawfulness. The most important thing he said this morning is he was asked whether he would let the Red Cross have access to these supposed prisons in Europe. And by the way, although they didn't admit it, it looks like the countries that are holding these prisoners are Romania and Poland.
Romania's already denied it, though, haven't they?
They have. But again, they are basing this on the CIA flights.
Yeah.
And the president refused to talk about the Red Cross. He went into his, anything we do to that effort, we do to this end. Any activity we conduct is within the law. We do not torture. And therefore we're working with Congress to make sure that as we go forward, we make it possible, more possible to do our job. There's an enemy that lurks and plots and plans and wants to hurt America again. And so, you bet, we'll aggressively pursue them, but we will do so under the law. How's that?
He is so articulate when it comes to anger and punishment. You just have to wonder what kind of childhood this guy had, because he is so articulate when he's talking about punishing and hurting
people. If I grew up with Barbara Bush as my mother, I might have turned out that way, too.
Yeah, remarkable.
She's known as this, you know, nice lady, but please, anybody who knows her says anything's further from the truth.
Yeah, now finally, Bush apparently has also said that if, for example, we were to change U.S. law so that China could buy American Airlines and China could buy United Airlines, and they certainly have the means to buy both of them, and Delta and Northwest, majority of the American flagged air carriers. And then we got in a little fight with China over Taiwan, and Taiwan said, that's it. Okay, we're just going to ground the entire U.S. air fleet tomorrow. There's nothing we could do about it. That's just fine with George Bush?
Well, I mean, George Bush obviously didn't address that today. But essentially, George Bush is saying by wanting to open up United States Airlines to be bought by foreign countries or by companies that are a foreign flag, clearly he's doing this because he believes in this free trade. But as you well know, as well as I know, what if the Saudis buy our airlines, put in Saudi pilots? Well, what kind of control do we have?
Right, and what if one of those pilots just happens to think that it would be a fine idea to fly into the Empire State Building or something?
Exactly, as remember that Egyptian pilot did.
Yeah, he committed suicide. Of course, that was more personal, apparently more personal reason stuff than it was religious stuff. But oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. So the Bushies march on. Ellen, thanks so much for the...
I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah, talkradionews.com. Ellen Ratner, thanks so much for being with us, Ellen. Yeah, good talking to you. Oh, boy. George Bush down in Panama today vigorously defended U.S. interrogation practices in the war on terror and lobbied against a congressional drive to outlaw torture. Now, isn't there a bit of a disconnect here? It's like saying, no, I would never rob a bank. By the way, we've got to do away with all those laws against bank robbery. You know, we really don't need laws against bank robbery. In fact, we shouldn't have them. In fact, we need to do it, but I would never rob a bank. Never do it. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. The website, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room or if you want to participate in our blog or message board, really, technically correct. You can post messages and have conversations with folks. And lots going on. It's one of those amazing days that sometimes you just think it can't get any weirder, right? It can't get any weirder. And then sure enough, it does. President George W. Bush and the current administration, this is our conservative alert for the day, just to tell you where these guys are at. Ronald Reagan had borrowed more money than every other president combined before him, although he borrowed much of it from Americans by selling bonds that were bought by Americans. And he borrowed that money, of course, to give it to his rich buddies, particularly the big corporations that put him into power, the defense industries who benefited from trillions of dollars in spending on Star Wars, and to make the economy look good, to make it look like we had a decent economy. I mean, give me $1 million, you give me a credit card with $1 million line of credit, or a $10 million line of credit, or $1 billion line of credit, and I can show you what it looks like to look like you're living large. Well, that's what Ronald Reagan did. He borrowed $1 trillion. $1 trillion. More than every other president in the history of the United States combined. And we are still paying the interest on it. In fact, this year we're paying $160 billion in interest on that. But now George W. Bush has passed a milestone that even Ronald Reagan hadn't thought of. He's now, of course, our borrowing now is pushing $8 trillion. But in terms of borrowing from foreigners, you recall it was France who helped us finance the Revolutionary War. We borrowed from France to, Louis XVI's problem was he couldn't quite handle not being paid back quickly. But in any case, we borrowed a lot of money over the years from a lot of foreigners to fight a number of wars and things. But all the other presidents combined of the United States before George Bush, when you combine them all, and most of that money had been paid back, by the way, it comes to $1.01 trillion. George W. Bush, now in just 4 years, or arguably 5 years, has borrowed $1.05 trillion. $300 billion more than any other, $30 billion more than all of the other presidents combined. Meanwhile, he basically says, if he says it, if he does it, it's the law, because we're at time of war. We have a clip of this. Fire it up there.
Our country is at war, and our government has the obligation to protect the American people. Executive branch has the obligation to protect the American people. The legislative branch has the obligation to protect the American people. And we are aggressively doing that.
Our country is at war, we have the obligation, and we are aggressively doing that. It's just amazing. I mean, actually, that clip, that apparently that wasn't the clip where he said, or unless it slid right by me and I didn't notice it, Alex, did he say in that clip that he has the power to make decisions? Alex? No, he didn't. Okay, yeah, that's not the clip. We got to find the clip where he said that. It's referenced in the New York Times today. So we'll try and track that down. But anyhow, so here we have George W. Bush basically saying it's his thing. And in the meantime, today there's an election in Seattle, in Washington State, among other places. I mean, there's elections all over the country. And in the meantime now, King County, which is where Seattle is located, or around Seattle, I'm not super familiar with the geography of that area, but I believe it is Seattle. I may be wrong. Somebody will correct me, I'm sure. Call and correct me if I am wrong. A county where, well, you know, Dino Rossi, his whole, all the his hissy fits and all this stuff about, you know, there's a right-wing talk show host here in Portland who always refers to the alleged governor, Christine Gregoire. just a few hundred extra Democrats, if a few hundred Democrats had been knocked off the voting rolls in King County, the election might have turned out differently in the state of Washington. Well, the Republicans said, okay, let's do that. This is from the Daily Kos. King County is the latest setting for the newest series of Republican dirty tricks. Using the 2004 gubernatorial election saga as an excuse, the Republicans have filed challenges to nearly 2,000 voter registrations within King County, Washington State's most populous county in a Democratic stronghold, just days before tomorrow's general election, Tuesday's general election. Did I say it's today? People can, in Clark County in southern Washington, they're voting by mail. They can vote today. In any case, just days before this Tuesday's general election tomorrow, thousands of voters have received letters in the mail informing them that their right to vote is being challenged by the Republican Party of King County. Now, this is incredible. It's an attempt to harass and intimidate King County voters into not going to the polls or not sending in their absentee ballots. I mean, you know, who wants to be threatened with this? And it seems that it's coming from King County Republican Vice Chairman. This is from the Northwest Progressive's diary. King County Republican Vice Chairman Lori Sotelo recently filed challenges to nearly 2,000 voters within the county, claiming that she had, quote, personal knowledge or belief, end quote, that those voters did not live at their registered addresses. And these people all received certified letters notifying of this. King 5 News did a pretty good job of this. There's a photo of it over at the Daily Kos. And here's what's really clever, notes the Northwest Progressive's diary. Here's what's really clever. The filing of the registrations, the challenges, was timed to be right on the eve of the November 8th election, so the hearings have to be scheduled after the election. The GOP is hoping that those voters whose registrations are being challenged will get discouraged and not even bother to vote. This is incredible. From the Stranger's website. So I get, this is a blog, so I get this certified letter from King County today informing me that my voter registration has been challenged. Attached is a form signed by some woman named Lori D. Sotelo saying that, quote, under penalty of perjury, quote, she has, quote, personal knowledge and believe that this person does not reside at the address given on his or her voter registration, end quote. Under the section where she is asked to provide factual basis for the challenge, she writes, quote, voter is registered to vote at an address that is not a physical residence, end quote. What? I live in a vintage apartment building in Belltown, the Watermark, with about 60 other people. When I talk to my neighbors, everyone I talk to also received that letter. Yes, that's right. The Republicans challenged the voter registrations of every single person in this apartment building. There's a picture of the apartment building. Others being harassed are people who have lived in the same house for decades and still others whose residence is where they operate their businesses. So if you run a small business out of your house, apparently the Republicans don't think that you should be allowed to vote, even though they say they're pro-business. Back to the Washington blog. Meet Kathleen Dolan. Kathleen is a soft-spoken woman who has lived at the same address on Queen Anne since she bought her house in 1975. With the exception of 6 years spent teaching at universities in Tennessee and Pennsylvania, she's lived in this house for 30 years. The last time she lived elsewhere was in the late 80s, and all that time she's always been registered to vote at one address, the home where she lives. But this week she received a letter from King County election officials telling her that her right to vote was being challenged by the King County Republican Party. I spoke with Teresa, this again from Washblog. I spoke with Teresa Bushnell, a resident at the home of Barbara Taylor, both voters who have been challenged by Mrs. Sotelo. Ms. Taylor manages a storehouse storage warehouse, and her home is on site, as many storage facilities require their managers to live on the property. So she has a business at her residence. Oh, God forbid, you can't have a business at your residence. Republicans won't tolerate that. Can't have that. Can't have that at all. It's just not right. Won't work. She goes on to say, I spoke with Teresa Bushnell, a resident of the home of Barbara Taylor, both voters who have been challenged by Ms. Sotelo. Ms. Taylor manages a storage warehouse, and her home is on site, as many storage facilities require their managers to live on the property. Ms. Taylor has four registered voters in her home, including Ms. Bushnell, and has lived and voted at this address for 11 years. And we're just getting started, writes the Daily Kos. Damien Hall writes, I am extremely disappointed and angry at the audacity of this woman, Sotelo, and the party she represents. That would be the Republicans, says Damien Hall, who got one of the letters. Hall has lived for 16 years at the Watermark apartment building at 320 Cedar Street in Seattle, her registration address. Hall, who said she is too African-American not to be a regular voter, said Friday she came of age in the Civil Rights era and watched her parents hand out political flyers outside polling places they were not allowed to enter. She says, we just buried Rosa Parks on Wednesday. I got the letter on Thursday. Today's my 57th birthday. And they're challenging my validity? Yes, notes the Daily Kos. Yes, Damien, they are. They're cowards who play dirty, attempting to disenfranchise you so they can win. They note, by the way, State Republican Party Chairman Chris Vance has been returning all calls made by reporters to Sotelo. Chairman Vance now acknowledges the watermark was included. Oh, by mistake. By mistake. African-American woman living at this building just happens to get a letter saying, don't bother to show up and vote. You can't. Your voting registration is being challenged. Yeah, Republican politics in America. This is the reason why it is so important to get these cons out of office. This is why it is just so vitally important that our quote for the day from Lord Acton, so true. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, calm down, George. Now, just calm down. No, just calm down. Well, welcome back. 9 minutes, 9.5 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. John in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, with votersunite.org.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Anyway, King County is the home county for Seattle, Washington.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And it's interesting that this vice chairwoman of the Republican Party in King County, or in Washington State, swore under penalty of perjury that the list of names that she had been out and looked at or had investigated the residences of this list of 1,988, I believe it was, voters, and that they've now probably well over 150, and I'm sure that the number is growing, of incidences where the information was just dead wrong. That's over 150 incidences of perjury on the part of Ms. Sotelo.
Any idea what the penalty for perjury is in the state of Washington?
No, I don't.
My guess would be probably 2 to 5 years in prison, but I just, you know, it probably has to do with the conditions and the circumstances.
Sure.
I wonder, though, how much jail time this woman is facing and if anybody's going to hold her accountable.
I doubt that anybody will hold her accountable. They'll just say, well, it was just a dumb political trick and go on from there.
But see, dumb political tricks, I mean, this cuts right to the heart of democracy, of what this nation's all about.
You're absolutely right. I agree with you 100%. What's really odd is that they've got a troubled election department in King County. They've had all kinds of problems. They're trying to dig out from under those problems and get to where they're administratively operating in good shape and everything else. The Republicans have been beating them up really bad over there, and they waited until 4 days before the election and then dumped this on the elections department and said, you guys have got a big problem. You better go take care of it. That resulted in lines on Saturday of ticked off voters who were being accused of not living where they were in real residences and so forth, and just caused all kinds of more problems. So along with everything else, if there are now any mistakes, administrative mistakes, after Tuesday, then they're going to be able to say, well, you know, you guys screwed up.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to get Lori Sotelo, the senior vice chairman of the King County Republicans, who swore under oath all these affidavits. And, John, you know, thanks a lot for your call and for pointing that out. We're trying to get her on the line right now. David, any luck? I just made your mic hot there.
No luck whatsoever.
Nothing.
Yeah, nothing at all. I called and left a message, and hopefully she'll call me back before the show is over and we can have her on.
Oh, you got voicemail?
Yeah, I got a voicemail.
I see. Okay. All right. You can also try, David, you can send her an email. Apparently it's lsotelo, L-S-O-T-E-L-O, at K, let's see, K-C, as in King County, presumably GOP.org.
Correct.
So check it out. Okay. Thanks, David. We'll see. We'll get back to you. We'll let you know what happens. So, Paul in Concord, Massachusetts. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I just want to comment that the president recently has said he can't comment on the investigation of Rove and Libby and Cheney. First of all, it's not a trial where he would influence the jury. This is just an investigation, so he can, in fact, comment legally. Secondly,
well, let me just qualify that. Libby is facing actually criminal
Libby
trial.
Libby now, yes, but in the other instances, he can comment in Rove, for example.
Yeah,
but
we all know that he's just dancing soft shoe around this thing.
But, more importantly, he takes the oath of office. He's the chief law enforcement officer of the United States of America and takes an oath to take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
Actually, he's not the chief law enforcement officer. The attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer.
No,
he's...
the attorney general reports to the president. The president commands the attorney general.
Right,
is the chief executive of this country.
Right, the chief executive, yes. He's also the commander-in-chief of the military, but he's not the commander-in-chief of the domestic, and he's not the chief law enforcement officer. That's the attorney general.
Well,
but we're splitting hairs here, but I get your point.
Right, so all he has to do is ask the question of Rove, and he legally has to give him the answer. Secondly, he's deficient in office in that, as you said, the chief military leader of this country, where a CIA agent has potentially been divulged, he has a constitutional obligation to investigate what happened. He himself and the president, the office of the presidency, has the obligation. He has failed in those two situations, so in my mind, those are grounds for impeachment, pure and simple.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that he has failed to keep this country safe and secure financially. We are now so deeply in debt that it's going to take us generations to dig out from underneath it. Every family in America is owing hundreds of thousands of dollars, much of it to the Chinese. We've put ourselves in an incredibly vulnerable position. We've outsourced and offshored so much of our manufacturing base and infrastructure in this country now that we can no longer even manufacture the necessary things for. We can't build a battleship. We can't build a missile. We can't fully uniform a soldier because all of our factories have gone offshore because of the so-called free trade. Now he wants to offshore our airlines, the ownership of our airlines, one of the few industries where there's still laws that say, you have to have a U.S. company owning this.
He's offshored our military in Iraq and the security forces.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're bringing in people from the Philippines to work for these private contractors to do the work. It's mind-boggling. Paul, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Got to wrap up this hour of the program here, the second of our three-hour program. But we'll tell you what happens. We'll tell you if we hear back from Lori Sotelo in King County, or any of the King County Republicans. In fact, if any of the King County Republicans who are listening to my voice would like to call the program, I will not be, I won't trash you. I'd love to hear what you have to say, and I will be respectful and let you say it. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. Give us a shout.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program, 6.5 minutes past the hour. So pleased to be with you. And I think now it's time for...
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, this is incredible. This is an actual memo written by Tom DeLay's aide, Mike Scanlon. Okay, just now, he's talking about his constituents. He's talking about Republicans who would vote for Tom DeLay or Republicans who would speak out in defense of DeLay. And, you know, and this indictment that has to do with all this mess with Jack Abramoff and the whole casino and the, you know, Indians and all that kind of stuff. Well, anyhow, here's the memo from indicted DeLay aide Mike Scanlon. Quote, "The wackos get their information through the Christian right, Christian radio, mail, the internet, and telephone trees. Simply put, we want to bring out the wackos to vote against something and make sure the rest of the public lets the whole thing slip past them." End quote. Yeah, I am not making this up. I'm not. This, I kid you not. I'm telling you, our quote for the day from Lord Acton is so true. He was a British historian. The last sentence of his quote is famous, but most people don't, you know, which is all power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. But most people don't know the two sentences that precede it. This Lord Acton, the British historian, writing in the late 1800s, he said, "And remember, where you have a concentration of power in a few hands, all too frequently men with the mentality of gangsters get control. History has proven that. All power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely." And again, to quote Mike Scanlon, indicted Tom DeLay, indicted aide Mike Scanlon, "The wackos get their information through the Christian right, Christian radio, mail, the internet, and telephone trees. Simply put, we want to bring out the wackos to vote against something to make sure the rest of the public lets the whole thing slip past them." He's basically laying out the source code of Republican victories. Distract everybody, all, you know, the average Americans. Come up with very simple names for complex programs, and then get the religious conservatives out to vote. I mean, it's just right there. That's another. This is another one of those things that you can bet is, you know, you heard it here. You won't hear it on NBC. On NBC, on CBS, on ABC, on MSNBC, on CNN, maybe on Keith Olbermann. Maybe on Keith Olbermann, but for whom I have tremendous respect, but in all probability, nobody else. This little bit of a note. By the way, I have put out a call. We are on, as you know, we are on radio stations all across the United States. One of them is in Seattle, KPTK, AM 1090, and Seattle, King County. And so if there are any Republicans in Seattle who would like to explain to us why the vice chair of the Republican Party there is under threat of perjury, swearing that this African-American woman who happens to have lived in this place for 30 years doesn't actually live there, why she's doing this, give us a call. I would love to hear your answer, and I'll let you just speak, and you can just put it right out. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Calling all Seattle Republicans. In the meantime, Marcia in Linwood, Massachusetts on the line. Hey, or Linwood, Washington, I'm sorry. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Oh, good morning. Am I on the air?
You certainly are.
Well, welcome. Greetings from Linwood, Washington, which is just about 20 miles north of Seattle, Washington. I wanted to let you know that I was involved in a massive voter registration campaign during and before the last general election.
2004.
Yes. And my concern is for the homeless voting. The homeless have a right to register to vote and to vote. And those who live in shelters, even if they can get in a shelter, may move from shelter to shelter or decide not to be in one because they're dangerous places.
Mm-hmm.
And we were instructed, not directly by our county auditor, but sort of secondhand, that if a person could describe the bridge he or she lived under and the nearest address, to go ahead and register them.
Mm-hmm.
And I did register one homeless person, so I think that's a big issue for me. There are more and more homeless people,
mm-hmm.
Thanks to this current administration. And
one statistic most people are unaware of, about two-thirds of homeless people in the United States right now are women and children.
Women and children and families. We have families who are homeless.
A lot of families.
In the Seattle area.
Yep.
So I wanted to make sure that the public is aware of that issue, too, and that many of us are just one check away from being homeless ourselves.
Well, yeah, and in fact, you remind me of a clip, E.J. Dionne, who writes A.J. Montini, writes a column for the Arizona Republic, I believe it is, and he wrote this marvelous piece about 2 years ago, in which he got a phone call, and that was left on his answering machine, and he put it on the internet, which is where I got it, and this woman who called and, you know, asked him to write about the issue of homelessness and just, you know, all the challenges and the difficulties that they're facing. And I'll just play this clip for you, Marcia, and I'm going to let you go so you can just hear the clip here.
Okay.
But I appreciate the call. Thank you. And this, the anonymous voice of the unemployed, he wrote in a column to the same effect. You can find a link to it off our website.
Voice call received 9:37 a.m. Tuesday, March 2nd. 2 minutes. To listen, press 0.
I'm calling in and I'm promising myself not to cry, but y'all's right about things that are going on in the current events. I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed? I'm 43 years old and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years. And we've always worked. A year ago, I lost my job. 6 months ago, his job was outsourced to India. We have three children. One that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college. But anyway, I just wonder, there's so many of us, and people don't seem to notice what's going on. And nobody, see, I read the paper, and I don't see a lot of people writing about it. And I know there's a lot of them out there because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, it'd be neat if somebody would write and make the country aware that, I feel like invisible. You go to the grocery store and it's like, anyway, we're an invisible section, but I think there's like millions of us. So anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything and you make it good. And nobody hears us. So
to respond or forward, press 1. To delete, press star D.
No, it was a message on A.J. Montini's answering machine, the writer for the Arizona Republic. A great column, and you can Google it. You can find it on our message board at tomhartman.com, a link to the original column and the original audio that he had on the web. And, yeah, our last caller, yes, many people in America are literally one paycheck away from destitution. In fact, a great piece in USA Today about a family, $200,000 in debt, not including their mortgage. Right. And how we think we can run an economy like this, and how we can, and George W. Bush is like oblivious to this stuff. You know, born on third base, thought he hit a triple, and just, you know, figures that's his world. And the average person, nah, screw him. You know, here, there's, you've got this budget reconciliation coming through. Cut Medicare, cut Medicaid. And by the way, if you're homeless, if you end up like this woman in a shelter, you can't vote, say the Republicans. You don't have an official house. There's hundreds of letters going out to people, you know, in King County, Washington. Incredible. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I get up every morning and ignore the global warming, head out to the Oval Office, start my day. I keep my donors all protected so I can be re-elected, give them access just as long as they pay. And to the corporate crooks who keep cooking up the books, we make sure we look the other way. The laws are theirs to break, long as I still get my take. My war chest keeps on growing each day. And I've been taking care of business every day.
As the George taking care of business. That's my way. It's the George W. Bush song there. Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. And Gene Cole Wells, a state senator in Washington, are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I understand you heard our conversation about what Lori Sotelo is up to.
I've heard part of it, and I wanted to let you know that I've already got Senate staff working on legislation to correct for this real sham. I think what the Republicans are doing is creating a mockery of very legitimate challenges that can be made, but these are not legitimate. I think it's nothing more than intimidation.
Senator Wells, or is it Senator Cole Wells?
Yes,
Senator Cole Wells. Senator Cole Wells. The thing that baffles me is the Democrats, by and large, and not even Democrats, people who are concerned about the vote and the legitimacy and all that of the vote are talking about issues like, you know, voting machines and people who want to get out the vote, you know, having people be available to vote and the integrity of the system, basically. And the Republicans are harping on this, for example, the Real ID Act, on this, what seems to me to be a largely non-existent problem of people voting who shouldn't be voting. It's not, I just don't get it. They think that all these illegal immigrants in the United States, for example, tomorrow want to go out and vote, or that people are going to illegally vote, when history shows us that most vote problems don't have to do with individual voters. They have to do with systemic problems. You know, whether it was, you know, Democrat Mayor Daley or Republican Ken Blackwell, you know, putting the wrong number of voting machines in certain precincts so people would have to wait in line for 8 or 10 hours. Are you attempting to address these kinds of issues?
Well, we certainly have in Washington State. In fact, we had a whole series of bills that we enacted in our last session last spring. And we want to make sure that people are legitimately able to vote and also do everything we can to not have votes suppressed, knowing that there are still changeovers in the machines that are being used, the methodology of voting, and that's happening all over the country. It takes money to do that correctly. But the voters that you had mentioned at the Watertown Apartments in Seattle are my constituents, and the 36 legislative district Democrats canvassed around this district over the weekend because of real concerns, and they found another problem. I don't know if you've addressed it, and that is with the liveaboards, people living on their boats, and we have several marinas in our district. And because of their requirement at the marinas that they have, that they use a mailing address that's a post office box, it appears there could be a legitimate question. And so what we're trying to do is make sure all those people know that they can contact King County Records and Elections even today and get that straightened out. In fact, I had an email from a constituent at the Shilshil Bay Marina in Ballard, and just irate, he said he's been registered to vote since 1964 in this in Seattle, in the state, and has never had a problem up till now. And he got his letter, and his wife did, on Thursday, informing that his vote would no longer count because of this challenge to his voting address.
From the Republicans. Now, it seems like, you know, I mean, I think the point that I was trying to make is that there is a legitimate concern about voter fraud being done by voters. There is also a legitimate concern about voter fraud being done by elected officials or people who have access to the voting process, the private corporations that, for example, secretly program the software. The vast majority of actual incidents of voter fraud that have been alleged over the last three election cycles, you know, the 2000, 2002, 2004, and we're talking about literally hundreds of thousands of sworn affidavits nationally, have had to do with corruption of the election system. And, you know, fewer than a dozen about actually wrong voters. And yet Republicans are using this wrong voters to bump people off the rolls. It's like, it seems that they're trying to tighten the standards up just so that they can disenfranchise more people. We're just about out of time. I'm sorry.
I agree with that. And also, as I mentioned earlier, I think they're trying to make a mockery out of a very legitimate statute that we have to allow for challenges to votes. And you know, we should preserve that. But we should not have that coming a few days before the election, which I believe can result in voter intimidation.
Very, very quickly, Senator Colwells, do you think that this Republican official has committed perjury?
I would say on the surface it appears that way to me, especially when we find these legitimate voters.
Will she be prosecuted?
We'll have to see that. I don't get involved with that. That would be King County.
Okay. We're out of time. I'm sorry. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate the call. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. And the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News.
And welcome back,
Daily
my friends. It's our Best of the Rest of the News segment. Time for this, the Tom Hartman radio program here, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Today we have with us Amy Goodman, the host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, a daily independent radio TV news hour, democracynow.org. Hey, Amy.
Hi.
Great to have you here. And also Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com. Mark, greetings.
Good afternoon, Tom.
And I want to hear from both of you here in this segment. You know, what do you see as the top news stories? Here it is Monday. Looking back on the previous week, what's coming down the road on the next week. Amy, first, your take on what over the last week or so are the things that you think years from now we'll look back and go, you know, that was a really important moment.
Well, first of all, this weekend, major protests in Argentina at the Summit of the Americas, tens of thousands of people protesting the free trade agreement, and particularly President Bush, and it was both around trade policies and also about the war. I think that's what's angered most people, not only in Latin America, but around the world. And that directly relates to the whole continued investigation of the Bush administration's pretext for war, weapons of mass destruction. The New York Times reporting that the Bush administration was warned more than 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago, that intelligence reports alleging ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda were likely fabricated by a member of Al-Qaeda in U.S. detention. And interestingly enough, that person, Ibn al-Sheikh Alibi, who was a detainee in U.S. custody, saying the Defense Intelligence Agency said he was lying. And it turns out he may well have lied after he was tortured, which goes to the whole issue of torture and the reliability of information that comes out of it. I think the big, big story next to war is that the U.S. is involved in torture of prisoners, whether it's at Abu Ghraib, whether it's Guantanamo, or now we know secret detention facilities around the world.
Amy Goodman, one of the things that distresses me the most, I think, when I travel internationally and speak. I last year spoke at Oxford University in England, and almost virtually before the students and there was a few faculty members, but most a couple hundred students would let me speak, I had to basically denounce George Bush. You know, it's that bad. We have, or to say at least, you know, I hadn't voted for him. He's not my guy. I know he's my president, but he's not my guy. The tragic damage that has been done to the reputation of the United States and the empowerment of torturers and dictators around the world that is being given by these kinds of policies and these actions by Cheney. How do we undo this?
How do we
clean up our reputation around the world? How do we say to dictators, no, it's not okay to torture, even though we did it last year?
By stopping the torture ourselves. I mean, the fact that this is being done in our name, whether we support the Bush administration or not, we cannot get away from what the rest of the world sees. They see this representing the United States. And it is astounding that we have an administration right now that, under President Bush in the White House, is pushing to continue the torture. You have Vice President Cheney directly lobbying Republican Senator John McCain, who got that amendment on the military appropriations bill passed that says the U.S. will not torture or treat cruelly or inhumanely prisoners. And Vice President Cheney personally lobbies him to exempt CIA employees. This is ridiculous. I mean, what is it that we're trying to show in the world that there is a better way? Here, Rumsfeld walks through Abu Ghraib and the former Saddam torture cells, and yet, what has the U.S. done with these torture cells? They continue the torture. We know about the Soviet gulag, right, the prisons and where people were tortured during the years of the Soviet Union. And yet what is now coming out is that the U.S. has this series of highly secret detention facilities where they're engaging in torture. This, you know, if not for moral reasons, which I think is reason enough that we should disagree, for practical reasons, what will happen to U.S. service members or officials who are captured in places overseas? What model are we presenting to the world, that it's okay to torture?
Yeah, it's incredible. Thank you, Amy Goodman. Mark Carlin of BuzzFlash.com. Amy makes an important point, and I'd like to just extend that a little and get your kind of editorial take on it, your opinion. The Bush administration seems to have obtained information that they used to get us into this war from a guy they tortured, this Al-Libi guy. And I'm just wondering if it could be, is this too weird a paranoid fantasy of mine to think that maybe the reason that they want to continue torturing people is so they can get wrong information when it suits their purposes? Because they used information that they knew was wrong as a result of torture to lie us into a war, Mark Carlin.
We've editorialized. In fact, today we have an editorial about what's the matter with Kansas, and it's that people voted for Pat Roberts.
That's not far afield from what you're talking about, because Pat Roberts has been sitting on the information as head of the Republican head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which would reveal that the Bush administration lied us into war on information based on torture, on false documents as in Nigergate and so forth. It is true that most experts that I have read about torture say you get out of it what you want to get out of it. That is to say, someone who's being tortured takes their lead from the person who's interrogating. And if the person who's interrogating has a certain outcome in their mind, the person who's being tortured is going to please them, because that's going to stop the torturing, at least for the moment, although we know that many people have actually died under torture.
Yeah, somewhere between 30 and 100, apparently.
Only a wild estimate, because we don't know, because the people are being held in the gulag in Eastern Europe. We don't know who they are or what happens to them, so it could be much more than 100.
Right.
But in any case, we had the very Orwellianly scripted moment this morning when Bush in Panama said adamantly, you know, indignantly, that his administration does not engage in torture, but that he was opposed to any congressional attempt to stop them from torturing. And one can only drop one's jaw, even after 5 years of the Bush administration, at a hypocritical nugget like that. It seemed to symbolize the paradox of the Bush administration that lies through its teeth and yet wants whatever it's lying about. In this case, saying, and David Addington, who just was appointed to replace Scooter Libby, one of the first things he said as Cheney's new chief of staff is we never torture, and he was one of the people that wrote up the memo for Cheney's staff, which basically said go ahead and torture. We also had former chief of staff of Colin Powell say just over the weekend that it was his belief that the authorization for torture came directly from Cheney's office. So we're seeing the president of the United States, whether he was duly elected or not, the person who was in that position, saying we do not torture. I mean, he is saying this in his position as president, when it is clear from the Washington, even the mainstream press, the Washington Post, not just Democracy Now! Or Buzzflash, is saying that we've tortured. We've seen that Abu Ghraib. We've seen in Guantanamo. We've seen the documentation of these gulags of torture in Eastern Europe. The president of the United States is saying we don't torture, but I'm opposed to any effort to stop us from torturing, even though we don't do it.
Yeah, it's sort of like saying, you know, I would never rob a bank, but let's do away with all the laws against bank robbery. But I would never rob a bank. Amy Goodman, excellent point, Mark Carlin, at BuzzFlash.com. Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!, you have been reporting on this forever. Do you know the number of people who have died under torture? Have you had an opportunity to come across that?
Well, I think we really don't know, because we don't even know all the places where people are being tortured.
Yeah.
Right, we're just learning now. The Washington Post on Wednesday talked about this this gulag of prisons where people are being tortured in Eastern Europe, and they, amazingly enough, complied with a Pentagon request not to name these sites. Now, Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archives has said this is a most egregious compliance that the Washington Post is engaging in, that it's absolutely astounding that they are covering for the administration's involvement in torture. What those who are investigating this are saying, Human Rights Watch are saying, they believe that it may be Romania or Poland when they look at the logs of secret flights of detainees.
Yeah, although Romania has denied it now officially.
Romania and Poland denied it, but this is what they're thinking. But the issue why the Washington Post would do the expose and then cover for where this is happening, we don't even know the number of places, so how can we know how many people have died of torture? We hear one story after another. I think what has been acknowledged at different points, what we know at this point is something like 24 people, but I don't think we can possibly say.
Yeah, that was mostly just out of Abu Ghraib, wasn't it? And Guantanamo, those deaths?
Yeah, the ones
that we know of, the official deaths, as it were. Yeah. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Amy Goodman, the executive producer of Democracy Now! and host, democracynow.org, and Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com. Our best for the rest of the news segment. Can you both stick around for another few minutes?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Great. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll come back, and I want to hear your thoughts from both of you about what you see coming up as the big news as we head on into this week. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
'Cause there's you and me, and all other people, nothing to do.
And welcome back, my friends. Welcome to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually, we'd just settle for democracy. I mean, it would be a good start. Welcome back. We have Mark Carlin from BuzzFlash.com and Amy Goodman with Democracy Now on the democracynow.org, BuzzFlash.com. On the program with us, our best of the rest of the news segment here, a weekly look at what's going on with some of the folks who are reporting the news and doing a marvelous job of it. Amy, what do you see coming down the road as the hot, you know, what do you see as the small story now that's going to blow up in the face of whoever's face it may be?
Well, I mean, I always think that the war is the biggest story, and it may not be in the front pages every day in Iraq, but that is the story that will haunt the Bush administration, not only during this administration, but through all of history, what the President Bush did and the pretext that he used and all that has ensued, whether it's the Valerie Plame Gate story, that's not a technical issue. It's directly related to going after whistleblowers who dared to question the lies. And I think that one is going to continue to blow up and haunt the administration as well. And, of course, the numbers in Iraq. And now it's more than 2,000, but that's just U.S. soldiers. And that's a horrific number. It's not just. But we have to add to that, multiply that over and over and over and over and over and over again. Yeah. And we won't even begin to get the number of Iraqi casualties. This
Amy,
is hardly paid attention to in the media.
Yeah, and Amy, with regard to the war in Iraq and the rationale for it, I notice on our call screening software here, Elizabeth in Kent, Washington, I don't have the time to put people on the air right now because we only have a few minutes left in this segment, but Elizabeth says allies, all intel said Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And I've heard this mantra repeated at least 30 times in the last 48 hours on various talking head shows on TV. Everybody thought he had weapons of mass destruction. My recollection is that's not the case.
I don't think so at all. I mean, but the fact is, and I think the reason Elizabeth thinks this is it's not her fault. I mean, I think people in this country are good media consumers, and the corporate media kept on beating the drums for war. Look at the front page of the New York Times. Maybe she often read it. She would believe that with Judith Miller and her front page stories over and over again alleging weapons of mass destruction. But there were many who were saying it wasn't true at the time, and certainly the administration knew it, because we're talking about people in the highest levels of intelligence as well as the military. Take someone like Scott Ritter. Take someone like David Albright. These are weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, chief UN weapons inspector. The media loved him when he was more militaristic, but when he started saying, no, wait a second, I was there, Saddam Hussein doesn't have the weapons of mass destruction, then he became a media pariah. And so the people who were raising the questions, and there were many to the highest levels of the military, just didn't get in the media.
And that's just in this country. I mean, you know, Elizabeth's point is that all around the world, there were world leaders who thought Saddam had the weapons. And my take on it was that they were not willing to join us in the coalition because they were not yet convinced.
That's right. I mean, they knew, they understood that it wasn't there. I mean, they have to rely on some intelligence, and often they don't have the sophisticated intelligence apparatus that the U.S. has. And the U.S. successfully scared a lot of people. The Downing Street memo is all about the Blair administration understanding full well that the facts were being fixed to support the policy.
Right.
And it's the reason why they went after Joe Wilson.
Yep.
I mean, this guy went way before the invasion, and he came back and said, no, I checked it. You know, he was willing to say that Saddam Hussein was trying to get nuclear weapons from Niger, and it ended up that he wasn't. He came back, he said no, and they said he was trying to get it anyway.
Yeah, well said. Amy Goodman with democracynow.org. Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com. What do you see as the big story coming down the road?
The question is, are the Democrats going to have the ability and willpower and stamina to pull what they did last Monday, which was, this is not business as usual, a maneuver that said, we are going to shake things up and get to the bottom of this. I think one of the great successes of the Bush administration from their perspective is they've created an environment where there's a certain banality to lying. As what Bush said this morning, we don't torture, but you need to let us continue torturing to protect you. People have come to accept this of the Bush administration. It's such a low standard that they find it acceptable. The news media says, well, there's no news here. Bush always lies, so what's the news? And unless the Democrats start shaking things up and holding people accountable and say, no, the national security of the United States is at risk, which, as Amy pointed out earlier, It's not a question of just being opposed to torture. These are incompetent people who are risking our national security. You have to be suicidal to support them. And the Democrats have to start saying that.
And you think the Terry Reid's moment of spine, you think this is going to continue, or do you think that they're going to go back to being kind of the quiet guys?
Well, they have for a week gone back to being the quiet guy, so we'll have to see if the spinal implant took for about a day. We'll have to see if it sticks.
A second operation
works.
Amy, what's your take on that? Amy Goodman.
Well, it would be a new day, that's for sure. When you look at the people appointed to the panel, like, for example, New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, where I'm from in New York, she has never retracted her support for the war, even with the pretext being exposed of weapons. Of mass destruction. She has yet to do that, just like, Kerry and Edwards. When Kerry was asked, when right near the election in the Grand Canyon, when he was asked if he knew then what he knows now, would he withdraw support? And he said no, he would still support it. But that was really a
nuanced response. He was saying, I would still give the president the power to be able to negotiate in the UN. I mean, that's what I think he thought he was saying, don't you?
I don't know. All I know is he never spoke out against the war in any serious way at that time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and is now only very tentatively, it seems, doing so. Hopefully they'll all get a spine implant. We'll see. Amy Goodman, democracynow.org, the website. Mark Carlin, buzzflash.com. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And keep up the great work, both of you. Two people who are heroes of mine and doing marvelous work out there in the world. It is 57 minutes past the hour. Well, we're wrapping up the show here today. Thanks so much for being with us, my friends. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Don't forget, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense and the radical
program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.